the Tolkien Road, episode 236, The Lays of Beleriand. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 236, The Lays of Beleriand. Greta, how in the world are you?
Hey, good.
Right on.
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Glad to be back on the road after an extended Easter break. Kind of a not something we exactly planned, but when you're Catholic, Easter's busy. Like, not just the day of Easter, but
Holy Week
is kind of a busy time. So,
yes.
Yeah, I was going to try to crank out a little bit of a later episode, but then work got busy this week and just, you know.
It's been busy.
That's life. So
it is. But you're right. It is good to be back.
It is good to be back.
Yeah. And so, a happy Easter to all of you.
A happy Easter. Happy Easter.
Yes.
On this episode, we are... I already said that. All right. off my game. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Elise Yu, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous.
Thank you all. Guys.
And a shout out to our newest patrons, Jay N. and Stephen S.
Thanks.
Thank you, awesome. Jay and Stephen, for becoming patrons. We really appreciate you.
So we do. Yep.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and land you some awesome perks. Check it out now to learn more about all the exciting perks we offer. Don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. You can also support the Tolkien Road by leaving us a one-time tip. Just look in the show notes on your podcatcher for the Leave a Tip link, or head on over to TolkienRoad.com and look for the blue Leave a Tip button. Of course, always, we ask you to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leaving us a 5-star rating and a review helps get the word out about us. And then check out our YouTube channel, TolkienRoad.com/YouTube. By the way, so I started recording the video of these episodes a few months back, and I was posting those for patrons only. I think I'm going to start making those available on our YouTube channel for those who want to watch the episode on the YouTube channel. So, if you're listening to this now, this episode will be available. I'm also going to make the other episodes that we did for the last few months available. So, so if you're the kind of person who likes to watch the podcast you listen to, likes to watch the shows you listen to, then check out our YouTube channel, go over there, subscribe, and you'll be able to watch us from now on. Just assuming that I always have my act together when it comes to recording the video. So, but I think I've managed to make it a pretty seamless part of what we do. So, yeah.
Cool.
Greta's a little annoyed by it, but I just told her to deal with it.
I am a little annoyed. So I like recording in my pajamas. What's wrong with that?
Well,
it's like, I
didn't say you couldn't record in your pajamas.
That's true. You didn't.
So.
Okay.
All right. Well,
there you go. Who knows what's to come, guys?
Hey, stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence and Tolkien news. We got some interesting correspondence to share with you this week, as well as a interesting little news bit about Lord of the Rings in the past couple of weeks, where they found a very strange old film production of The Lord of the Rings that you probably have never seen before.
But so who's they?
The they.
Yeah. Okay.
So you'll find out. Yeah, stick around to the end of the episode and find out who the they is.
Well, shoot, I was planning on peacing out like right now, but now I guess I gotta stay.
No, you gotta stick around.
Unbelievable.
You're such a slacker.
I am a slacker.
All right. Greta.
Yep.
Let's lay down the Lays of Beleriand, shall we?
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Clever. Let's lay it down.
On this episode, we will be providing a brief overview of The Lays of Beleriand, which is the third volume in the History of Middle-earth series. It was published in 1985. So I thought we'd start off, just quick review. We're plugging through a survey of the history of Middle-earth, which is, so we're not going in-depth, but it's still no easy feat, because the History of Middle-earth is a very complex 12-volume series that is not so much a history in the sense of like legendarium history. It's not like it's the annals of Gondor. It is a textual history. It is a pretty academic work. So my goal here was to survey the entire series the History of Middle Earth series, identify some places we might want to come back, kind of understand what's in there, and then say, okay, what do we want to come back to later on in future episodes? On the last several episodes, so we first of all did a survey of the Unfinished Tales as kind of a precursor to this, because it was really where Christopher started to explore the idea of doing this kind of textual history of his father's unpublished works. And then we spent some time on the first two volumes, which are collectively known as the Book of Lost Tales. So there is a chronological kind of order to these first few volumes. The Book of Lost Tales were really, these were Tolkien's first attempts at writing down the prose version of these stories. So go back and listen to those episodes if you want to know what we're talking about there. Now we're jumping into The Lays of Beleriand. And this is we'll get into what that is in just a second. But I wanted to, first of all, just establish what a lay is. So, by the way, I assume I'm saying that word lay right within this context. It's L-A-Y. That's how I would say it, as a American, you know, 21st century speaker of English, I would say lay for this word. But if I'm saying that wrong, someone is always, please let me know. So from the Wikipedia definition, the Wikipedia page for a lay, and this is actually the Wikipedia page for a Breton lay. Again, I think I'm saying that correctly. This is what they call it. A Breton lay, also known as a narrative lay or simply a lay, is a form of medieval French and English romance literature. Lays are short, typically 600 to 1,000 lines, not what I'd normally think of as a short poem. Okay, I guess it's all relative. They're short rhyme tales of love and chivalry, often involving supernatural and fairy world Celtic motifs. The word lay or lay, L-A-I, is thought to be derived from the Old High German and or Old Middle German like, which means play, melody, or song, or as suggested by Jack Zipes in the Oxford Companion to Fairy Tales, the Irish word laid, which is a song. So really, like, this is a, you know, we're talking about here, or like, this is a lay is a poetic sort of song. It's a long narrative song. Despite what they say about it being short, you're going to find that these lays that we're talking about here are anything but short. They are actually quite long. So,
well, we are talking about Tolkien.
We are talking about Tolkien, as we always do on the Tolkien Road.
Right.
So I'll link to that page so you can explore a little bit more about this idea of the Breton lay there. So, we're used to with things put together by Christopher, this starts off with a preface. This volume begins with a short preface where he lays out a summary of the book's content. So first he speaks of the lay of the children of Húrin. So I'm going to read a little bit about what he has to say about the lay of the children of Húrin in the preface. The alliterative poem was composed while my father held appointments at the University of Leeds from 1920 to 1925. He abandoned it for the lay of Lythian at the end of that time and never turned to it again. I have found no reference to it in any letter or other writing of his that has survived, other than a few words cited on page 1, and I do not recollect his ever speaking of it. But this poem, which though extending to more than 2,000 lines is only a fragment in relation to what he once planned, is the most sustained embodiment of his abiding love of the resonance and richness of sound that might be achieved in the ancient English meter. It marks also an important stage in the evolution of the matter of the elder days, and contains passages that strongly illumine his imagination of Beleriand. It was, for example, in this poem that the great redoubt of Nargothrond arose from the primitive caves of the Rhodothlim in the Lost Tales, and only in this book was Nargothrond described. It exists in two versions, the second being a revision and enlargement that proceeds much less far into the story, and both are given in this book. All right. So the first major chunk of this book focuses on the lay of the children of Húrin, which we of course know from the Silmarillion as of Turin Turambar. You know, is the later prose version that was included in the Silmarillion. So we can kind of see by the dates that it seems like this is somewhat continuous with the end period of the Book of Lost Tales, and he's undertaking this big project. I mean, very significant project of like creating basically an epic poem out of some of these stories, right? And this is apparently his first major stab at doing just that. By the way, Greta, do you know what we mean by alliterative poem? Alliterative. Yeah.
Alliterative. Nope. I don't think that I do. Does it have to do with the structure of it?
Well,
or
does it
like tell a story?
I was just gonna say alliteration, like as the alliteration is.
I know what
alliteration
is, yes.
So I'm gonna check myself here, because I wanna make sure that I'm on track with that. So again, I'll link to this in the show notes. This is the Wikipedia page on alliterative verse. So alliterative verse is a form of verse that uses alliteration as the principal ornamental device to help indicate the underlying metrical structure, as opposed to other devices such as rhyme. So, alliteration has to do with repeating consonant sounds throughout a work.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this, an alliterative poem, instead of rhyming, having rhyming couplets or something like that, right? The primary kind of pleasurable thing you're going to hear from the poem is alliteration throughout, right?
Cool.
So that's what he's doing here.
It appears that Beowulf was written is an example of an alliterative verse.
Yes, Beowulf is probably the one that comes to mind first for me as being written in alliterative verse.
Right.
So,
which we all know Tolkien was a huge fan of.
And not
and
only
actually
a huge,
did his own translation.
Actually,
of,
did his and, own translation.
Yeah.
Exactly. So. It turns out also, and this is something we haven't covered, but the Finnish Kalevala, which was also a very influential work for Tolkien, as well as Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which he did a translation of.
Okay.
So
also alliterative.
That's correct.
Huh.
So also alliterative poems.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it seems to have been a very Northern European favorite of Northern European culture in that kind of early medieval period. Early Middle Ages. So, so the first big chunk of this book is focused on the Lay of the Children of Húrin. By the way, it's approximately 2,000, it's a little over 2,000 lines. So this is not a small undertaking, right? That is a long poem by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this second Christopher speaks of the Lay of Lithian, which is a poetic version of what we'd later know as Beren and Lúthien.
Oh.
Now, if you thought the Lay of the Children of Húrin was long, the Lay of Lithien is over 4,000 lines.
Like
so it's twice the length.
As long.
This one was primarily written during the period of 1929 to 1931. And it's actually not an alliterative poem. It's actually written in octosyllabic couplets. So that would mean eight syllables per line and then rhyming couplets, right?
That sounds complicated.
It is. I mean... For anyone who's ever written poetry, you know that it is not easy, right? So, I mean, the fact that he could knock out 4,000 plus lines of octosyllabic couplets is amazing.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah. And again, just gives you an indication that Tolkien was not only an incredibly creative individual, but a absolutely brilliant man as well. So
yeah, and it's just like, it kind of makes my head swim a little bit because you're like, oh, he's already written the tale of Beren Lúthien, right? The story is there, and it's beautiful, and it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just like, yeah, I think I'll write a poetic version of this. Like, I mean, to me personally, and I'm just not the same type of person, clearly. I've been like, oh, you have a perfectly good version already written. Why would you rewrite it in octosyllabic couplets? Like, I don't understand.
And, it's like... This is what he was doing in his free time.
Right, right.
So the next time you're like, doom scrolling the interwebs, right? Or, on social media, like just scrolling through, right? Maybe just say to yourself, Tolkien wrote more than 4,000 lines of octosyllabic couplets in his free time.
Yeah.
And I'm scrolling through the internet right now looking for who knows what. And maybe that'll be a little...
Tweak to the conscience
to use the life that's been allotted to you to do something a little more creative with that time. I know it's a good check for me, so that'll be a good check for me, I should say. All right, so yeah, these two long works constitute the bulk of Tolkien's writings and the Lays of Beleriand. So let's take a little closer look at the. But there's actually five chapters, so let's take a little closer look at the four-ish chapters, four plus a little something at the end.
Wait, that so these are the two main.
These are the two. I'll explain. Just trust me. The bulk is what I just mentioned, but there's a little more to it.
All right.
So the first chapter is the Lay of the Children of Húrin, this one on Túrin Túrinbar, right?
Okay.
It's obviously a poetic version of the Children of Húrin. So I'm going to read a little bit from Christopher's introduction on this one.
We've not discussed the Children of Húrin on this podcast, have we?
Not the long book, but we discussed the Túrin Túrinbar when we did the Silmarillion. I think it's two or three episodes on that one. So.
Okay.
All right, here's what Christopher has to say at the beginning of this chapter. The Children of Húrin exist in two versions, which I shall refer to as 1 and 2, both of them found in manuscript and later typescript. I do not think that the second is significantly later than the first. It is indeed possible, and would not be in any way uncharacteristic, that my father began work on 2 while he was still composing at a later point in 1. 2 is essentially an expansion of 1, with many lines and blocks of lines left virtually unchanged. Until the second version is reached, it will be sufficient to refer simply to A and B, the manuscript and typescripts of the first version. So,
Okay. So two different versions.
Two different versions.
The same lay.
Yeah, but you know, one is two seems to be an expansion of one. Mm. There are differences, but you know, it's still basically we're dealing with that story. Okay. A little snippet, little example passage here from the Lay of the Children of Húrin as well. The title on this, by the way, is Túrin, Son of Húrin, and Glorund the Dragon. Mm. Lo, the golden dragon of the god of hell, the gloom of the woods, of the world now gone, the woes of men and weeping of elves, fading faintly down forest pathways, is now to tell, and the name most tearful of Niniel the Sorrowful, and the name most sad of Thalion's son Túrin, overthrown by fate. Lo, Húrin Thalion and the hosts of war was whelmed, what time the white-clad armies of Elfiness were all to ruin by the dread hate-driven of Delu Morgoth. That field is yet by the folk named Ninin Unothradin, Unnumbered Tears. There the children of men, chieftain and warrior, fled and fought not, but the folk of the elves they betrayed with treason, save that true man only, Thalion Erythamrod, and his thanes like gods. There is host on host, the hill fiend orcs, overbore him at last in that battle terrible. By the bidding of Baugleir bound him living, and pulled down the proudest of the princes of men, to Baugleir's halls in the hills builded, to the hells of iron and the hidden caverns they hailed the hero of Hithlum's land, Thalion Erythamrod, to their throned lord, whose breast was burnt with a bitter hatred, and wroth he was that the rack of war had not taken Turgon, 10 times a king, even Finnweg's heir, nor Feanor's children, makers of the magic and immortal gems. For Turgon, towering in terrible anger, a pathway clove him, with his pale sword blade, out of the slaughter, yea, his swath was plain through the hosts of hell, like hay that lieth all low on the lay, where the long scythe goes. A countless company that king did lead through the darkened dales and drear mountains out of ken of his foes, and he comes not more in the tale. But the triumph he turned to doubt of Morgoth the evil, whom mad wrath took. Nor spies sped him, nor spirits of evil, nor his wealth of wisdom, to win him tidings whither the nation of the gnomes was gone. Now a thought of malice, when Thalion stood bound unbending in his black dungeon, then moved in his mind that remembered well how men were accounted all mightless and frail by the elves and their kindred, how only treason could master the magic whose mazes wrapped the children of Corthun and cheated his purpose. So that's 50 lines. That's the first 50 lines of the poem. Sorry for my slip-ups. Sometimes there's words in there that you're not quite sure how to pronounce, as always with Tolkien. But yeah, you kind of get the alliteration feel there, Greta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
I think it's pretty cool. I love it.
It is really cool.
I've long said that alliteration is probably my favorite
literary device.
Yes.
Yeah, I like me some good alliteration too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can tell too. Like obviously, you know, I mentioned earlier, like why would he bother to rewrite a story he already has written in a different form? But now I'm kind of like, there's obviously, I mean, there's clearly differences, but this is meant to be read aloud.
Yes.
You can tell, right? Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, I feel like, to get the gist of a poem or a lay by reading it silently to yourself. So now I kind of understand, like, mm-hmm. the purpose, you know, there's clearly a purpose in him doing two different versions.
Yeah, well, if my understanding is correct, the where this sort of poetic, I mean, I think a lot of these, like, ancient cultures, this was how a lot of times they passed on their, like, myths was right. through these, like, and it was oral, mm-hmm. right? It was, like, right. you know, it was an oral tradition, so... you know, and I think, and like, I think what we have of Beowulf is basically that. It's like the oral tradition that was somebody eventually wrote down. I mean, I don't know nothing about the textual history of Beowulf or anything like that. But my understanding is that's where we got a lot of these things, is they were just kind of, you know, within the culture as these like legends that were, you know, and they were in poetic form often because they were easier to remember that way.
Right.
And they also, like, right. they were more appealing that way to yeah. tell, right?
For sure.
They would be sung, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's yeah. what Tolkien, you know, is probably trying to accomplish with all this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's pretty cool. And again, you just, you love this about Tolkien, that he was just, you know, that this guy, really where he was coming from was he was a nerd about, like, medieval you know, culture, like mm-hmm. the ancient cultures, and he used that extreme geekdom to you know, become the godfather of geekdom, of modern geekdom, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So so pretty cool. I mean, it's 2,000 lines. That was only 50 of those lines. So it astounds me to think that there were people who, like, you know, could recite even 50 lines, and then they would go around and recite like 2,000 lines of a narrative poem for somebody. And that's kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear if anybody who knows more about this tradition can tell us more about, like, what this might have been like in the contemporary context, right? Like, when people were doing these, was it like one person would know this, or would, like, different performers go around and they, like, know different parts of it, or
right, or if one person could
yeah
memorize that whole thing?
Do we know anything about the, like, the tunes that it went to, you know, any of those questions?
Yeah.
Just be interested to know, like, more about that.
Mm-hmm.
It'd also be interesting to know if Tolkien had a tune in mind for this. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe.
It
would be cool. I'm sure, just with all, you know, I feel like a lot of our listeners have shared different, you know, music inspired by Tolkien, things like that. I can't imagine there isn't someone out there that's kind of imagined a tune for these lays.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah.
For sure. Let's see here. I'm going to read a little bit from the second version. The second version, the latter half of what I wrote is somewhat similar, but the opening 14 lines are a little bit different. So I'm going to read the opening 14 lines here. At this point, it was just titled The Children of Húrin. Ye gods who girt your guarded realms with moveless pinnacles, mountains pathless, or shrouded shores, sheer uprising of the Bay of Faerie on the borders of the world, ye men unmindful of the mirth of yore, wars and weeping in the worlds of old, of Morgoth's might, remembering not, lo, hear what elves with ancient harps, lingering forlorn in lands untrodden, fading faintly down forest pathways, in shadowy isles on the shadowy seas, sing still in sorrow of the sons of Húrin, how his webs of doom were woven dark, with Niniel's sorrow, names most mournful. I think that's even better. Mm-hmm. I think that's really cool.
I like that too.
Yeah, very cool stuff. So that's a little taste of chapter one, The Lay of the Children of Húrin. In my little mass market paperback copy here, it is, you know, with Christopher's commentary and everything, it's 157 pages just for that one chapter.
And it's pretty small print too.
And pretty small print. So, you know, and like I said, over 2,000 lines of alliterative verse there. All right, chapter two is titled Poems Early Abandoned. Mm-hmm. So apparently Tolkien had a mind at one point to not only do Children of Húrin and Lay of Lithien, aka Beren and Lúthien, as these long epic sort of poems, But he had a mind to do three other stories from you know, these kind of these tales of Beleriand, right? So the these lost tales. So Christopher finds these, and he shares what we have of these. It's not nearly as long. Apparently, you know, Tolkien never really spent a whole lot of time on any of these, but we know that at one point he thought, oh, maybe I'll give this a start and see where it goes. These all seem to date from the early 20s period when Tolkien was on staff at the University of Leeds. So the first one is The Flight of the Noldoli, and it's there's 146 lines we have from that. I'll go ahead and read the first 16. And this is titled The Flight of the Noldoli from Valinor. Ah, the tree of light, tall and shapely, gold and silver, Ah, the trees of light, tall and shapely, gold and silver, more glorious than the sun, than the moon, more magical. O'er the meads of the gods, their fragrant frith and flower-laden gardens gleaming, once gladly shone. In death they are darkened, they drop their leaves from blackened branches bled by Morgoth, and Ungoliant the Grim, the gloom weaver. In spider's form, despair and shadow, a shuddering fear, and shapeless night she weaves in a web of winding venom that is black and breathless. Their branches fail, the light and laughter of their leaves are quenched. Murk goes marching, mists of blackness, through the halls of the mighty, hushed and empty. The gates of the gods are in gloom mantled. So
that's lovely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar imagery for those of us familiar with the Silmarillion there.
Indeed. Yep.
The next one is the next little snippet we have is from, this one requires a little bit more explanation. So I'm going to read what Christopher has to say about this one. He says, there exists one other piece of alliterative verse concerned with the matter of the Lost Tales, the opening of a poem that has no title and does not extend far enough to make clear what its subject was to be. The fall of Gondolin, the escape of the fugitives down the secret tunnel, the fight at Kristhorn and the long wandering in the wilds thereafter are passed over rapidly in what were to be the introductory lines, and the subject seems about to appear at the end of the fragment. All this have others and ancient stories and song unfolded, but say I further. And the concluding lines refer to the sojourn of the fugitives in the land of willows. But at the end of the text, my father wrote several times in different scripts, Erindel, Erindel son of Fingal, Erindel Fingalson, and I think it is extremely likely, even almost certain, that this poem was to be a lay of Erindel. On Fingal, see the next section. The text is in the first stage of composition and it is exceedingly rough, but it contains one line of the utmost interest for the history of Erindel. It is written on examination paper from the University of Leeds and clearly belongs in time with the lay of the Children of Húrin and the Flight of the Noldoli. More than that seems impossible to say. So, anyway, so it appears to be the lay of Arendelle, right? This other little snippet that Christopher uncovers here. And then lastly, in this chapter, we have what appears to be the lay of the fall of Gondolin, right? So basically what Christopher doesn't really give much of the text of this, but basically what he says is, basically, I guess what it appears to me, so much of what Christopher says, it's hard to piece together exactly what he's saying. But what I was able to take away is that this is basically maybe a first stab of Tolkien trying to convert one of his prose writings, prose tales, into a poem, because mm-hmm. Christopher shows where he basically just took a passage from a prose version of this story and wrote it in a more poetic looking form, right? So in page 176 of my copy, it's basically the same words, it just they're broken up into these poetic lines, right? So Christopher was just like, I don't really think this is really worth sharing with you because it doesn't really add anything to what you already have elsewhere.
So it's basically the same story, same words, everything, just structured differently.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what it appears to be.
Okay.
So that's chapter 2, Poems Early Abandoned. And now we move on to chapter 3, which is the Lay of Lithien. And, of course, better known to us as the Tale of Tenuviel or Beren and Lúthien. So Christopher says this, my father wrote in his diary that he began the poem of Tenuviel during the period of the summer examinations of 1925, and he abandoned it in September 1931 when he was 39. The rough workings for the whole poem are extant, and rough means very rough indeed. From them, he wrote a fair copy, which I shall call A. And then I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, and he says, the date November 29th at line 3031 is followed by a substantial amount of composition in the last week of September 1930 and again in the middle of September 1931. The last date is 17 September of that year against line 4085, very near the point where the lay was abandoned. Details of the dates are given in the notes. There is also a typescript text made by my father, of which the last few hundred lines are in manuscript, and this text ends at precisely the same point as does A. The typescript was begun quite early, since my father mentioned in his diary for 16 August 1926, having done a little typing of part of Tenuviel, and before the end of 1929 he gave it to C.S. Lewis to read. On 7 December of that year, Lewis wrote to him about it, saying, I sat up late last night, and having read the jest as far as to where Baron and his gnomish allies defeat the patrol of orcs above the sources of the Narog and disguise themselves in the Raif, I can quite honestly say that it is ages since I have had an evening of such delight, and the personal interest of reading a friend's work had very little to do with it. I should have enjoyed it just as well as if I'd picked it up in a bookshop by an unknown author. The two things that come out clearly are the sense of reality in the background and the mythical value, the essence of a myth being that it should have no taint of allegory to the maker, and yet should suggest incipient allegories to the reader. So, little comment, and there's more shared of C.S. Lewis's commentary on this epic poem, The Lay of Lythian, elsewhere in this chapter. He gave pretty, you know, a lot of notes back to Tolkien about it, but it's cool to see Lewis really applauding his friend, you know, well before anybody else in the world really knew who Tolkien was, right? You know, 6 years before The Hobbit was going to be on anybody's radar. And here Tolkien is providing a lot of encouragement to him and calling out exactly those things that we all, you know, really two things that we all really love about Tolkien's work, right? The sense of reality in the background and the mythical value, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems real. It has that verisimilitude. Mm-hmm. And it's not an allegory. It's a story that suggests all these symbolic connections that we might call allegory until we realize that there's no attempted allegory going on. It's just, you're seeing connections within it, right? You're seeing connections to things that you're aware of within it. Because
it's very personalizable.
It's very personalizable because it is so well told and written. So, let me read a little bit. And let me just say this too. So Christopher says about the abandonment of this. He says, my father abandoned the lay at the point where the jaws of Karkaroth crushed together like a trap on Baron's hands and the Silmaril was engulfed. But though he never advanced beyond that place in the narrative, he did not abandon it for good. When The Lord of the Rings was finished, he returned to the lay again and recast the first two cantos and a good part of the third and small portions of some others. So, again, with all these things, there are a lot of notes. Christopher provides a ton of commentary in these things, and I'm really just kind of giving you all a little taste of what you can find in it. But if, you know, if you're all interested to dig more, I highly encourage you to do so. All right. So a little bit from the jest of Baron and Luthien. A king there was in days of old, ere men yet walked upon the mold. His power was reared in cavern shade, his hand was over glen and glade. His shields were shining as the moon, his lances keen of steel were hewn. Of silver gray his crown was wrought, the starlight in his banners caught. And silver thrilled his trumpets long, beneath the stars and challenge strong. Enchantment did his realm enfold, where might and glory, wealth untold, he wielded from his ivory throne in many-pillared halls of stone. There beryl pearl and opal pale, and metal wrought like fish's mail, buckler and corslet, axe and sword, and gleaming spears were laid in hoard. All these he had, and loved them less than a maiden once an elfiness. For fairer than are born to men, a daughter had he, Luthien. Such lithesome limbs no more shall run on the green earth beneath the sun. So fair a maid no more shall be from dawn to dusk, from sun to sea. Her robe was blue as summer skies, but gray as evening were her eyes. 'Twas sown with golden lilies fair, but dark as shadow was her hair. Her feet were light as bird on wing, her laughter lighter than the spring. The slender willow, the bowing reed, the fragrance of a flowering mead, the light upon the leaves of trees, the voice of water more than these, her beauty was and blissfulness, her glory and her loveliness, and her the king more dear did prize than hand or heart or light of eyes. So again, that one's written in octosyllabic couplets, so it does employ rhyming, but you still hear a lot of alliteration mm-hmm. within it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just struck by just how beautiful that
it's
is.
Absolutely
and how,
lovely.
And yeah. it's a different experience of this story.
It
like,
is. Mm-hmm.
That was 40 lines, and I'm just like, it's almost like a, it helps you visualize.
It really does.
Everything. It really yeah. like kind of puts you in it.
It does. And I feel like, it's weird because I feel like in a way this is more of a stripped down version. Like it's just kind of like, just the high notes.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels much fuller in a way too. I really want to read the rest of that actually.
Well, it's only 4,000 lines, so go for it. So
I mean, you could probably read it faster than you could the actual written tale of Beren Lúthien in the Silmarillion, don't you think?
I don't think you understand just how many lines, 4,000 lines of this is.
Maybe
it's
I
a
don't.
Lot. It is a lot, right? And it just makes this effort by Tolkien that much more amazing. I mean, look, I'm just showing you, like, this is where I started, right here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is at a little over halfway through.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, now,
I still want to read the rest of it. It might take me longer than I think.
Well, I think this is one we could come back to later and do a series on, right?
That'd be great.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. We could spend like a long time just on this one thing, but you know, as much as we love, you know, Beren and Lúthien, mm-hmm. love that story.
Yeah.
This seems like it could be just an amazing way to experience that story. Now, some of that length is Christopher like. Provides commentary like between the cantos. And if you've read Dante, you might be familiar with the idea of a canto, right? There's like different, like it's basically the sections of these sort of epic long poems. So, anyway, Christopher provides commentary between each of them. So that's some of the length as well, but I mean, it's still a lot. I years ago, I actually undertook to read the whole thing and I have really bad shiny object syndrome, so...
Wait, the whole of the lay
of
life?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I just have really bad shiny object syndrome when it comes to reading, so I only got maybe 1,000 lines in. But even that 1,000 lines, it like took me a while, right?
It's very dense.
Yeah.
Like, it's beautiful.
I feel like I'd want to read it aloud, you know?
You would need to, I think.
Or have somebody read it aloud to me.
Yes.
Which
yes.
I think is one of the shames of, like, I would love if there was an audiobook version of... the history of Middle Earth and or at least some parts of it, because it's almost like somebody needs to like go through and just be like, take out Christopher's commentary and just provide us
with
the lays of Beleriand, just like let us have them.
I
and
agree.
You know, without the commentary,
that's a great idea,
and so we could listen to him as like an audiobook or something like that. So anyway, just a little thought there.
Yeah, it's good.
And then yeah, and like I said, C.S. Lewis's commentary is contained in here as well. I think there's also another commentary, although I didn't spend a lot of time trying to find it, but apparently there was another commentary somebody provided on this much later. Christopher doesn't know who provided this commentary, but it was a very thorough and critical commentary. So so somebody else spent some time with it as well. All right, and then chapter 4 is The Lay of Lúthien Recommenced. Basically, as I understand this, it's a much shorter chapter than the last one. Basically, like Christopher said at the beginning of the last chapter, when Tolkien finished the draft of The Lord of the Rings around 1950, he came back to the Lay of Lúthien and undertook it again. So, so this chapter contains what part of that work he was able to get through. As I'm scanning here, it looks like close to 700 lines.
Did he just rewrite it or did he finish it?
No, he like started to rewrite it. So
okay, so he never finished it.
Right. So
okay.
I mean, and I don't know that the rewriting was a complete rewrite. It may have just been editing what he'd done in the past, but trying to kind of work from. Using what he done in the past, but working from scratch, so he wasn't too influenced by it or something like that. But, I mean, that's a lot of time to pass, right? So if he was writing, if the last time he touched the old version was 1931 and not coming back to it for 19 years, that's a lot of time to pass. Mm. And furthermore, he'd written The Lord of the Rings in that time, right? So he developed this whole other later history that right. was referred to this history. So, you know, it'd be interesting to think about how that story would have developed in that time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally.
All right. And then the last part of this book is, it's pretty short towards the end, and it's kind of hidden. It's almost like you wouldn't notice it, but it's called A Note on the Original Submission of the Lay of Lythion and the Silmarillion in 1937. So what I'll say about this, it's a really interesting historical biographical note that leads to a pretty fascinating what if concerning a critical juncture in the history of the Lord of the Rings and the rest of the Middle-earth legendarium. So basically it has to do with the meeting of Tolkien and the publisher Stanley Unwin. After, you know, this is late 1937, so this is after The Hobbit has hit and it's a big success, and Unwin's like, okay, what else you got, right? And if you remember, Tolkien shared a bunch of different things, mm-hmm. one of which was the Silmarillion as he had it at that time, mm-hmm. and apparently he shared the Lay of Lythion as well. And so the note is basically Christopher looking at some of the evidence for how we understood what happened in that. I won't spoil it too much for you, but I'll basically just say it's a pretty interesting little note and leads to this curious little what if something had gone a little bit differently there. Hmm. So
interesting.
Yeah. Remember, that was a pretty pivotal moment because that's when Unwin was like, yeah, all this is nice, but you know, we'd really just like more stories about hobbits. And that's where Lord of the Rings came from, right? So, and Tolkien was like, I really want to publish the Silmarillion, right? So he had to kind of do... You know, so that eventually became like the sequel to The Hobbit, but it's going to be more like The Silmarillion, right? Mm-hmm. So, all right. So that is a quick survey of the Lays of Beleriand. So, volume three in the history of Middle Earth. on episode 237, we'll survey volume four, The Shaping of Middle Earth. So,
oh,
yeah.
All right. Sounds good.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so so this news story that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, that was kind of interesting. So here's the headline. This was shared with me by one of our patrons, Adam, shared this with me. So thank you, Adam. I kind of saw this, you know, in the kind of all over the place the last few weeks in Tolkien circles too. So it's interesting to find this, but basically. Soviet TV version of Lord of the Rings rediscovered after 30 years. So, and it says the Russian language film posted on YouTube delights fans with its rudimentary sets and ludicrous special effects.
Anything that has the word ludicrous, then it has my attention.
Yeah, right. So it's a 1991 made-for-TV film based on The Fellowship of the Ring. And it's, you know, apparently the only adaptation to have been made in the Soviet Union. There's an article I'll link to it, which also I think links to some of the highlights. But and I know you at YouTube, watching us on YouTube are not gonna be able to see us because I'm not sharing my screen on this. But I'm gonna watch it with Greta because it's only 30 seconds long, and you might hear the audio. So and you can kind of gauge our reaction and go watch it for yourselves. So you can hear some of the audio too. Хоббиты не воинственный народ и никогда не ссорились друг с другом. So, oh, wow. I mean, yeah, y'all need to go check this out because it's kind of a trip. It's trippy and kind of a trip.
So is the whole thing available on YouTube?
I think it may be. So I'll try to find the... Yes, it looks like it's available.
It's a series. It's not a movie. It's a TV series.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, but anyway, it is a, you know, so this is not... they did not have the Peter Jackson's budget for this, nor the technology that
is
Peter
it subtitled?
Jackson had.
It's not subtitled, is it?
I don't know if it's subtitled. I don't know if somebody's taken the time because it was made for Russian
right,
speakers, right?
Yes, so, okay. I'll send it to my dad, have him translate it for us.
But it was discovered, it was basically like thought to be lost, and then somebody discovered it here recently and posted it to YouTube. So anyway, it's an interesting little artifact on many levels. First of all, because it's a visual adaptation of Lord of the Rings. Second of all, it's left over from the Soviet era, right? And third, it kind of shows why it's probably a good thing that nobody tried to do this in the West before Peter Jackson did, other than the animated attempts, because you couldn't have pulled it off, right, before Peter Jackson did. I don't think you couldn't have pulled it off well. It would have come off in really the wrong way, and it makes you glad that Tolkien wasn't greedy to sell out his film rights and cash in. You know, I shouldn't say that, like that he what that that he had a high standard, and he wouldn't just, like, the first person who came along and was like, hey, let's do a Beatles version of Lord of the Rings. Like, he didn't do that, right? So, mm-hmm. Y'all got to check it out. It's pretty cool.
It is. That was fun.
All right. A couple pieces of correspondence. The first one is from Eric O. on March 24th. Not that one. Let's see. Here we go. There we go. There's Eric O. The subject is framed. Eric says, hi, John. I can't think of many novels that use a frame. Greta's example of The Princess Bride is typical. This novel is short, and so the frame is modest in size. You have to have a frame that's appropriate for the painting. Imagine a large, gaudy frame surrounding a tiny, minimalist still life. It's just not right. As I listened, I immediately thought of Tales from the White Heart by Arthur C. Clarke. I read this as a child and was always impressed with the idea. Yet this one is likely lighter than The Princess Bride's frame. To think of a Lord of the Rings size frame, you have to think about some big fat novels that can support a sizable frame. In contemporary literature, I think Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut fits that bill. If you are unfamiliar, the protagonist Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time, somewhat along the lines of Tolkien's time-traveling ideas. In the classics, I think of the Odyssey. So many stories in that story. I haven't read any of these in a long time. Worth a reread, I think. Eric.
That's a really good point he makes about the frame needing to fit up the size of the novel. Like,
yeah.
That makes a ton of sense. I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But he's right. I mean, that it would be quite an undertaking to find a frame that could support something like The Silmarillion.
Well, I think I referred to it, referred previously to my favorite short novella, which is Youth by Joseph Conrad. And Conrad actually uses the same frame narrator in that story that he uses in what's his best known work, which is Heart of Darkness, right? It's Marlowe, I think. It's been a while since I've read it, but it's a very, I don't know. I like the idea, even if it's just somebody like people sitting there telling stories to each other, you know, like I like that sort of, and that's how of course they did it in The Princess Bride. And that's something seems to be of what Tolkien was trying to achieve with the Book of Lost Tales.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, it doesn't have to be super complicated. I like the idea that, I don't know, just something about that really like works with my imagination.
I feel like it makes it more relatable, and it can really... Yeah. I mean, I feel like frame, just that's what a frame does, right? I mean, it just surrounds it and kind of sets it off, you know?
Yeah. Well, in that sort of frame of having somebody tell the story to somebody else, and then you're kind of like drawn into it that way, it makes you feel on par with the person who the story is being told to, right?
Yeah, so, more relatable.
Yeah.
And the whole story within a story thing is cool anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Good stuff, Eric.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. We have another, come back to this one. Let's see another note on the same idea, on this idea of frames. So this is from, Jennifer. Jennifer said, she commented on episode 234 and said, The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux. It has a prologue in which the author as the narrator claims that the opera ghost was real and relates how he went about investigating the history of Eric and the other characters, and then describes the Paris Opera House. The book ends with an epilogue telling of the earlier years of Eric's life, from his birth to his arriving in Paris. First-person narration is also used by some of the characters to give the story a stronger frame. Also, The Help by Catherine Stockett.
Hmm.
It is written entirely in first person, with one exception, with three distinct narrators. Let's see. So, well, I'll leave the rest of your... that's the portion on the frame. I'll leave the rest of the comment there for those who want to read it on the blog. I'm not... I have never seen... I know what Phantom of the Opera is, but I've never actually seen Phantom of the Opera. Have you?
I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple times performed. I've never read the actual story that it's based on, though. So, that did not pop into my brain as a frame, but maybe that's because the way it's performed is different than the way it's written. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But The Help, I have read The Help, and I that one didn't pop into my brain either, but...
Do you remember that now?
Yeah, I guess I'm a little... I guess I'm realizing that maybe there's different ways to define a frame.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like the Princess Bride example is a very kind of a traditional frame. But then when Eric mentioned The Odyssey, I wouldn't have thought of The Odyssey, but that is a story within a story.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then The Help, yes, there's multiple narrators, but I guess I don't really, you know, that's maybe a less traditional frame. I don't know. I guess I'm a little... I'm trying to understand completely, like, the scope of frame narrative, maybe.
I mean, for me, it can be a large or small scope. I just think of a frame narrative as, like, you know, you are acknowledging the existence of the person telling the story, of the person relating, of the person narrating as an actual person.
In the story,
right?
Yeah.
Even if that's just something as simple as, like, hey, I'm your grandfather, I'm here to read you this story, right? And we're going to have some back and forth during the course of me reading you the story.
Right, but the grandfather that's reading the story to the kid in The Princess Bride isn't in The Princess Bride story. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but that's not, like, the frame is not that he's in The Princess Bride story. The frame is that exists outside of it, right?
Right, so it's a story within a story. Yeah. I just need some time to let my brain wrap around
it can get a little convoluted, I guess, when
The Help, the narrators are actually in the story.
Yeah, are they recounting past events?
Yes.
Yes. So, like, that's similar to what how Youth and Heart of Darkness are, right?
Okay.
Like, this character, I got to find out. I got to remember what his actual name is. I think it's Marlo. Let's see here. It is Charles Marlo. Yeah, so Marlo in both of those stories, he's basically recounting events he experienced, right?
Okay. See, I guess that's not how it's happening in The Princess Bride, though.
But hold on. But he's doing it not as like, hey, I'm this disembodied voice who's telling you these things, because that would just be like, that would be more like, Call Me Ishmael, right? Moby Dick, right? So Moby Dick begins, Call Me Ishmael, and, you know, this guy who experienced all the things in Moby Dick is telling us this, but we don't know anything about where he is now or who he is or anything like that. But with Youth, Marlo is sitting in a bar at the beginning of the story talking to these other people, and there's this famous refrain within it, which is one of my favorite things, where he says, you know, every once in a while he'd be talking and be like, pass the bottle, right? So they're all sitting around drinking, right? But that's the whole thing, is they're in this bar and he's like, pass the bottle. Hey, let me tell you about this one time when I was, you know, when I was young. It was my first sea voyage, right? And he starts going into the story. So, and it goes back to them sitting in the bar every once in a while, right? And then he gets back into the main story continues, right? And that's how it is with The Princess Bride. You have the grandfather comes in, talks to the grandson, and he's like, I'm going to read you this book. And then you get into the book, and then they come back to it. Now with Youth, Marlo is actually the character in the story. With Princess Bride, neither the grandfather nor the grandson are characters in the story.
So it can work both ways.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay. Maybe that's where my hang up
goes. But the point is that the frame narrative would be that there's a narrative, even if it's just a scanty little one, right, that exists outside of the main story,
that
right?
Makes sense.
That's going on, you know, that the narrator, I guess, exists in with you, right, as you're being told the story.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know. I love the idea of a frame narrative. It's a fascinating topic to me. Cool stuff. Thank you, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And then we have a note from David Bigwood from March 30th. Let's see here. David says, Dear Greta and John, concerning a new version of the Silmarillion, if done properly, it might be interesting. I'm old enough to have grown up with the Beatles, and recently some of their albums have been remixed. Of course. Mm-hmm. I find all interesting, and I like the Abbey Road remix as much as the original. It would have to be the right person. Aside from adding a frame, different works could be included. The Tale of the Tongues and the Grey Annals, replacing works concerning the Second and Third Ages. Just playing with the ideas. Cheers. Yeah,
I like that idea.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm... I like the idea of a remix. And again, it's, you know... I think you don't want to get rid of the Silmarillion as we have it now. But maybe it's like the Silmarillion... I don't know. Yeah, you wouldn't call it remix because that's really a music thing. But the idea of the remix, right, of doing something, a new version of the Silmarillion, or however you might do it. But yeah, it'd have to be a good writer for sure. Like, you know, somebody who's an avowed Tolkien snob. Yes. And is not going to settle for, you know, just whatever pleases, you know, whatever pleases the corporate suits, as they say. Yeah, and I like the I actually prefer Let It Be Naked to Let It Be the original version of the album on a personal level. I just don't like all of the so Let It Be was like one of the Beatles'
like
last albums.
The studio kind of so, effects yeah, with, and stuff like that.
With and a criticism for a long time was that Let It Be as an album had too much basically they gave it to I think Phil Spector, who was the Wall of Sound guy, Wall of Sound producer, and he like added all these strings in and everything. So like, you know, the song, The Long and the Winding, Long and Winding
yes,
Road,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So the version you're familiar with has like the long and winding road. And it's like, bum, bum. It's like all the
I
horns and strings.
Love it.
Well, it's nice enough as it is. And it's the version everybody knows. But if you, the Let It
Take
Be Naked version,
away.
Like took all that stuff away. So it's just kind of like, it's a very stripped down sort of sound. It's almost like an unplugged version of the song.
Okay. More raw.
And the whole thing was that like, that was how the Beatles actually wanted it in the first place. And somebody, you know, whether it was, I don't know if it was George Martin or somebody had come along and said, we're going to add all this other stuff onto it. Anyway, this is not a podcast about the Beatles, but just to say that this does have precedent for having been done in the past. And I think as long as they keep the Silmarillion as Christopher gave it to us, and then maybe it's a, you know, the Silmarillion re-envisioned or something like that, right? They need to give it a cool name, but you know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
Or maybe just call it the Red Book of Westmarch, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, maybe do it like that, right?
And then
have the frame narrative with, you know, just different familiar Hobbit, Lord of the Rings characters talking to one another and telling these stories. That might be cool. So
maybe you're onto something.
I think I am, and I think they need to hire me to write it. No,
there
I'm just
go.
Kidding. Don't hire me. I would screw it up.
True.
So, all right. Yes. All right. Well, that's everything. Hey, we'd love to hear from you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, even Instagram now. Although our daughter gave me a hard time. She's like, you never post to Instagram. I was like, well, I've posted a little bit with my Tolkien account. She's like, oh yeah, I'm just talking about your like personal Instagram. And I'm like,
I didn't know you had a personal Instagram.
I didn't either, but I think you do if you have Facebook or something, like you're automatically. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, we're on Instagram too. not real well.
Kind of, sort of.
Never been great at the whole social media thing. All right, next episode. As we said before, Volume 4, The Shaping of Middle-Earth. All right. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following. Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Lise Yu.
Andrew T.
John R.
Ms. Anonymous.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Sam N.
Mike M.
Duren Nayer.
Robert H.
Paul D.
And Jacob S.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you all very much. And also a shout out to Jonathan D., who is celebrating his patron anniversary this month. So
awesome. Cool.
Well, thank you all so
yes,
much.
Thank you, guys.
And we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.